Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the President's address from the U.S. military complex at Bagram in Afghanistan, where he outlined the exit strategy for 2014 and touched on the history of America's longest war on the first anniversary of the killing of al-Qaeda's leader. Political scientist John Mueller, the author of Terror, Security, and Money, Balancing the Risks, Benefits, and Costs of Homeland Security, joins us. He has an article at The National Interest, Why Al-Qaeda May Never Die. Then we will speak with a Pakistani lawyer, Shahzad Akbar, who is the co-founder of the Foundation for Fundamental Rights, an organization representing victims of drone strikes in Pakistani courts. We will discuss the recent clarification of drone policy by the White House and what is happening on the ground in Pakistan in terms of victims of collateral damage from drone strikes who are suing the U.S. and Pakistan governments. Then finally, we will hear from a Canadian peace activist who was captured in Iraq by a jihadist group calling themselves the Swords of the Righteous. Held in brutal captivity for 118 days, his American companion murdered, and all the while hiding that he is gay, he was eventually freed by a joint SAS and U.S. Special Forces team. James Loney, the author of Captivity, 118 Days in Iraq, and The Struggle for a World Without War, joins us to discuss how a pacifist dealt with murderous extremists and being rescued by soldiers who risked their lives to save his. Joining us now is John Mueller, a political scientist recognized for his ideas concerning the banality of ethnic war and the theory that major world conflicts are quickly becoming obsolete. He's currently the Woody Hayes Chair of National Security Studies at the Mershon Center for International Security Studies and a professor of both political science and dance at Ohio State University. His books include Overblown, How Politicians and the Terrorism Industry Inflate National Security Threats and Why We Believe Them, Atomic Obsession, Nuclear Alarmism from Hiroshima to Al-Qaeda, and his latest, Terror, Security, and Money, Balancing the Risks, Benefits, and Cost of Homeland Security. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Mueller.
Thanks. Great to be here.
And John, you've got a piece in The National Interest, Why Al-Qaeda May Never Die. The administration is sending out mixed messages. On the one hand, trumpeting the death of Osama bin Laden a year ago, at the same time talking about the continuing threats that al-Qaeda poses. Now, apparently, some of the material that was captured by the SEALs a year ago, which bin Laden supposedly hid in a file of pornography, is being released by West Point, or that counterterrorism center at West Point, very soon. Do you think these documents are likely to give us any insight into al-Qaeda? My understanding is that what bin Laden is saying in these documents is, that the whole thing's a disaster and they're knocking off all of our leaders and everything is just as bleak as could possibly be.
Yes, I would. It will say a lot, and it will say mostly that. Basically, the whole effort has been a fiasco, going back to the reaction to 9/11. Also, a thing that he stresses a lot is how counterproductive their actions have been, particularly in Iraq, where the whole population is turned against the al-Qaeda types who are running around in that place, to the point where he's even talked about trying to change the name of al-Qaeda as if that would solve the problem. So it's been, what I could take out of it is that we've been massively exaggerating the importance of this ridiculous group that got very lucky once, unfortunately.
And is that something to do with our political DNA, with Manichaeanism? Is it the need to have an enemy? I mean, we had a very tailor-made enemy for so long in the Cold War with the Soviets. They were perfectly cast as the evil empire. And I'm wondering whether there's a need for an enemy and if we'll take whatever we can get.
Well, sometimes it certainly seems that way. I think there's less a need for an enemy than when there does seem to be a threat, there tends to be a strong effort to exaggerate its importance. So my main concern is not that there aren't any threats, that there aren't any problems, but that when they rise into consciousness, we massively exaggerate their importance and their capacity. That happened even in the Cold War. The whole idea that the Soviet Union was going to invade Western Europe at any time if we gave them a chance is, judging from documents that have been coming out, pouring out of the former Soviet Union, that whole idea is really preposterous. Not that there wasn't a problem, not that they didn't oppose capitalism and democracy, but they did not see anything like Hitlerian invasion as being relevant or remotely sensible. But we tended to worry intensely that they would do that. We also much exaggerated the capacity of domestic communists to do much of anything. Basically, they were a pathetic group that couldn't subvert their way out of a wet paper bag. And from time to time, we've exaggerated the effects of various rogue states and rogue dictators like Castro and Nasser and Sukarno and Saddam Hussein and Khomeini. So I think that has been a pattern. And basically, it's not that every threat suddenly, everything seems to be a threat, or we always need a threat. But once we see a threat, there's a tendency to exaggerate its capacity. And it's really important in international relations to get the threat right, quantitatively. That is, see big threats as big threats and small threats as small threats, and not simply see every threat that you can imagine as a large one.
Again, I'm speaking with Dr. John Mueller, who is the Woody Hayes Chair of National Security Studies at the Mershon Center for International Security Studies and Professor of both Political Science and Dance at Ohio State University. His latest book is Terror, Security, and Money, Balancing the Risks, Benefits, and Cost of Homeland Security. But, of course, the other dimension to this, surely, John Mueller, is the fact that paranoia and standing up for America, etc., are political weapons in domestic politics. You know, the legacy of Roosevelt and the power of the Democrats was almost disappeared overnight in the 50s when the canard was floated that if you are progressive on domestic issues, you are therefore aiding and abetting a foreign enemy. And the Republicans were able to take over the House and the presidency. And ever since, the Democrats have been on the defensive about not being tough enough on communists and by extension now in this so-called war on terror, not being tough enough on terrorists. And who we have a Republican congressman accusing the House of having 80-plus Communist Party members in the Democratic caucus. I mean, it lives on as a divisive issue. And as you probably recognize, John, it's being used now between Romney and Obama about who is the best to take out bin Laden.
Yeah, the sort of the macho lesson and so forth. Well, taking out Osama bin Laden was obviously a good thing from anybody's ideological or partisan perspective. As I mentioned in that article, Americans' chance of being killed by an international, by a terrorist, any kind of terrorist, is about 1 in 3.5 million per year. And it seems to me that some policymakers someplace who get paid to do a responsible job should occasionally say that, but it basically never gets said, nor does it get much said, I must say, in the press or in the media.
Well, particularly the way, by the way, just I didn't mean to interrupt, but particularly the way that you've mentioned it in your article, Why Al-Qaeda May Never Die in the National Interest, you point out that, you know, the statistics are that you have about a 3.5 million chance per year of being killed by a terrorist. At the same time, you have a 1 in 22,000 chance of becoming a homicide victim, a 1 in 8,000 chance of perishing in an automobile accident, and a 1 in 500 chance of dying from cancer. So that does put it in a pretty clear perspective.
And that's the perspective people should have and be presented with. Now, they may still be afraid. I mean, people, you can give the statistics about how unlikely you are to crash in an airplane, and some people say, well, I know the statistics, but I'm still afraid of flying. And people do have that perspective, but they should at least know it. And when you got responsible policymakers who are constantly saying things like, a terrorist could strike at any time, anywhere, and with virtually any weapon, and never leaving out the fact, however, your chance of being killed is about 1 in 3.5 million per year, they're simply not giving the full information. It may be that the full information doesn't alleviate the fears, but they're not even trying, and I find it extremely irresponsible.
Well, but the opposite is happening. It's not that the press is giving us that kind of objective information about the real threat of terrorism. They are, in fact, drumming it up all the time. They talk about Al-Qaeda's ideology of global jihad and how they are working with Iran, sharing a common enemy, which is absurd, how they're involved with Boko Haram, the Nigerian group, which seems to be completely homegrown. And, of course, everything that's going on in Somalia is attributed to Al-Qaeda, as it is in Yemen, not looking at what's really happening in both of these countries, which are that they're failed states and everybody's got a gun and, you know, it's hard to know who the hell's on what side when.
Yes, that seems to be a major problem. That's why I think Al-Qaeda could never die, because there's always, we keep lowering the bar. Al-Qaeda Central, it seems to be, is being accepted as pretty much moribund. However, then you say, oh, but there's all these other people who call themselves al-Qaeda, and they might be just as bad. So now we have to worry about Yemen and Nigeria and Somalia and the Algeria, as if they were the same thing. And most of these most of these groups are very ineffective. And furthermore, if you get some guy who just decides to shoot up some pub someplace while saying hooray for al-Qaeda, then they say, oh, there's another link and so forth. And so consequently, since we have this sort of wide encompassing definition of what al-Qaeda is, if anybody can shoot up a pub and then suddenly revive the memories of al-Qaeda, then al-Qaeda will always, the potential for al-Qaeda always be around will be there, I'm afraid.
Again, I'm speaking with John Mueller, political scientist and author of Terror, Security and Money, Balancing the Risks, Benefits and Cost of Homeland Security. The president made that secret trip to Afghanistan and spoke at Bagram Air Force Base yesterday. And in his speech, he mentioned why things and how things went wrong in Afghanistan after a very, you know, thorough defeat of the Taliban, and how bin Laden was able to escape into Pakistan, a bit of a dig at the Bush administration. But, you know, the more you look at that, I mean, without being conspiratorial, John Mueller, it's pretty hard to understand why Rumsfeld, and I imagine Cheney had a hand in it too, why they let him escape. I mean, is it possible they let him escape for the very reasons that, you know, as you mentioned in your article, that when recently Defense Secretary Leon Panetta said that they are basically within reach of strategically defeating al-Qaeda, all of the terrorism experts went into palpitations because heavens forbid that this thing goes away. So why do you think Rumsfeld let bin Laden escape?
Well, I think they were actually trying to get him. They would like nothing better than to parade his head on a pike through Washington, D.C., I'm sure. It was mostly various forms of screw-ups. They're also overly conservative about the dangers to American lives, and they were letting the Afghans take the lead between the Bora Bora episode, which is where he made his actual escape. So I think anybody would have liked to get him if they could at various times. It just took a very long time to do so. I do think that Obama's also saying in there that it's really important that we keep Afghanistan from becoming another safe haven. And this safe haven myth has been around for a long time, that 9/11 couldn't happen unless they had a safe haven someplace. I mean, there's 19 guys, the total number of people involved in the whole conspiracy is probably 30 or 40 at the most. And you don't need a whole country to hold up in order to do that. And so the whole idea that Afghanistan would be this haven or something, that no one could put together a tiny conspiracy like that any place except in a large country, it's just really preposterous. But he does that because that's the only reason that he can give that would justify for the American public staying in Afghanistan, since there isn't much stomach for interventions that are purely humanitarian. You have to somehow show that this is important to American security. And waving that flag seems to be politically effective.
Well, of course, it never made any sense in terms of Afghanistan being a safe haven for al-Qaeda. There's no question that Mullah Omar did give bin Laden protection, but the actual plotting of 9/11 actually took place in Hamburg, I believe.
And that's right.
And
mostly.
We're certainly not...
The relationship between al-Qaeda and the Taliban is extremely strained. They were never invited. They just sort of showed up, and the Taliban then sort of let him stay. But the deal was from the get-go that if he wanted to stay there with his wives and his friends, that was okay, particularly if he paid, you know, a certain amount of money and taxes and other ways. But that he was not supposed to deal with any kind of international terrorism or even propaganda in favor of terrorism. And bin Laden repeatedly, obviously, culminating, of course, in 9/11, repeatedly went against his solemn promise to Mullah Omar from the beginning. So that in many respects, he was on the outs with the people who were supposedly protecting him. And they might have been willing, particularly after 9/11, to turn him over to the authorities, though they were never really given that opportunity.
So when the neoconservatives who are making a comeback now, in spite of their manifest disasters that they've befell American national security and international relations, particularly the ill-fated war in Iraq and the extent to which it's benefited Iran, they're still taking credit for the fact that there hasn't been a terror attack since 7 years ago in London. And, you know, the reason for that is you're arguing it's not that all of this bureaucracy that we put in with Homeland Security and taking your shoes off at the airport, it's not so much that. It's the fact that they've just degraded this leadership, I imagine.
And the Al-Qaeda, which was always a very small group, is a fringe group of a fringe group, insofar as it did take out actions, and it hasn't really done very much since 9/11. Except as act as an inspiration for a few people and provide a bit of training. The key fact also is that any time it did try to do anything, it was counterproductive. People don't like to be blown up, as Americans should certainly be able to appreciate. And when you set up a bomb in a hotel wedding in Jordan, the Jordanians react in a way that's reasonably predictable. Namely, they turn against you. And so then, and that's what, as we started talking about at the beginning, is what Obama, anyway, Osama bin Laden was well aware of, that they had basically been doing nothing to speak of except kill a bunch of Muslims, which is turning exactly the people who are supposedly on their side against them.
So do you expect some clarity then in the area that you are? You're pretty much a lone voice, John Mueller. Again, he has an article at the National Interest, Why Al-Qaeda May Never Die. I mean, I recall, you know, a year or so ago, former Secretary of State Colin Powell did warn about the growth of the terrorism industrial complex. And that, I think, has definitely befallen us, hasn't it? This massive Homeland Security bureaucracy, for example. Difficult to know what they do. They don't even know what they do.
Yeah, that's right. It's amazing the fantastic amount of money that's been thrown at the problem since 9/11, and that there's been almost no evaluation of it. That's in the book I did with Mark Stewart called Terror, Security, and Money that came out last year. We actually try to apply just standard routine risk analysis to the effort to try to deal with the terrorism hazard, the same way you'd apply it to other hazards, natural hazards like hurricanes or earthquakes. And we conclude that the money has been met, there's been met, given the size of the threat, which is pretty limited, the amount of money thrown at it, not even including the wars overseas, but just the domestic costs, has been wildly disproportionate to the threat and danger that Al-Qaeda presents. In order to justify it, in fact, in order to justify the increased expenditures, you'd have to demonstrate that the increased expenditures have deterred, disrupted, or protected against something like one Times Square type attack every single day since 9/11. That's how wildly disproportionate these expenditures have been. But it's not an easy sell, and the ball just keeps rolling, self-licking ice cream cone, sometimes it's called in Washington.
Well, it seems, though, that given the president's speech at Bagram Air Force Base, where he talked about this new agreement that they have with Karzai, of course, Karzai has always been considered a huge part of the problem since he won't do anything about corruption, which is rife within his own family, that this idea of leaving this country in 2014 is pretty much dead on arrival, isn't it, in terms of any achievements? I mean, do you seriously think that the Afghan army is ever going to amount to anything, and that there's not going to be anything but a resumption of civil war?
There's always that as a very severe danger, that's for sure. They're going to give it the best try and try to train as many as they can and then just leave. If it works, even roughly, then everybody will forget about it. But even if it collapses into civil war, I don't think there'll be very many Americans paying much attention to it unless you can demonstrate that there's some direct threat to the United States because of activity there. But he is sticking to his timeline, and I think he's getting increasingly serious about it. And of course, he did lay down the gauntlet, saying, "We're out of here at the end of 2014, and you better start taking that seriously." So maybe that'll work. We'll see.
He certainly got the American people behind him. I mean, you know, they recognize this thing has been a massive waste of time, of life, and treasure. It's never going to amount to anything.
I think it's likely to have further resonance in the future. I call it the Iraq syndrome, or maybe we should call it the Afghanistan syndrome. There's a big effort to, including among Republicans, to say, let's not do that kind of nonsense again. Rather like the syndrome after Vietnam, in which the United States decided maybe we shouldn't do Vietnams again. So we may have a sort of a movement against these kinds of dangerous and costly interventions.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Dr. John Mueller.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Dr. John Mueller, political scientist recognized for his ideas concerning the banality of ethnic war and the theory that major world conflicts are quickly becoming obsolete. He is currently the Woody Hayes Chair of National Security Studies at the Mershon Center for International Security Studies and a professor of both political science and dance at Ohio State University. His books include Overblown, How Politicians and the Terrorism Industry Inflate National Security Threats and Why We Believe Them, Atomic Obsession, Nuclear Alarmism from Hiroshima to Al-Qaeda, and his latest Terror, Security, and Money, Balancing the Risks, Benefits, and Cost of Homeland Security. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking with a Pakistani lawyer representing victims of drone strikes in Pakistan's courts.
The terrorist war and danger. September 11th. Terrorism. Global terrorism. Terrorism. Terrorist. 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 The terror. Terrorist. Terrorist. Terrorism. September 11th. Global terrorism. Terrorist. Terror. Terrorism. September 11th. World terrorism. Terrorist. Terrorism. September 11th. Global terrorism.
September the 11th. Terror. 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 Weapons of mass destruction. September the 11th. September the 11th. Terrorists. The evil terrorists. 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 No.